Phil Hayes Show.
Hello there and welcome to the show. The Phil Hayes Show is brought to you by The Athletic and The Square Ball. I'm Dan Moylan, and from The Athletic, Phil Hayes.
Hello.
And The Square Ball, Michael Normanton.
Hello.
Back in your usual chairs. Thank you for covering for me last week. How was it, Michael?
Thank you for editing it into something vaguely acceptable. It was a bit all over the place.
I wish people could have heard the raw version of that and back to front, inside out and all over. Like Michael says, total mess. But as a result of your tidy stitching, beautiful.
It was Phil's fault. He insisted on having guests on and they're all in the wrong order and stuff. It was hard work. But yeah, thank you for coming back.
And the good news, if you caught the Square Ball podcast earlier in the week, I was saying I was off because my son's been in hospital for a couple of weeks. He gets to come home today, which is good. So thank you very much to the Leeds Children's Hospital for their sterling work across the last couple of weeks.
Absolutely.
To celebrate Black Friday, we are giving you the chance to subscribe to The Athletic for the best ever price, just £1 a month for 12 months, and you can cancel at any time. So you can access all of The Athletic all year long, including all of the podcasts, including this one, ad-free, and Phil will bring you unrivaled coverage of Leeds United for an unbeatable price. It's an offer that's not going to be beaten anytime soon, and it runs from Black Friday for just 1 week up until the 4th of December, so get on this one quickly and don't miss out. This week, Phil, we've got Rafinha, bits on Cock, Elliot, the virtual mascot for the Arsenal game as well.
Yeah, I had a chat with his family and Elliot himself last night. Blown away, I think he was, by the experience of Sunday. I've never seen anything like it. And when we got to the ground, we were told that it was happening and that they were going to try and do this virtual experience for him. And to have seen the video of it and the way they worked it out for him, it was really quite special. And even more so because of his story, 2.5 years of coping with a really quite aggressive and serious form of cancer, which they seem to have under control and are treating as best they can. But it was an amazing little tale, that, and lovely to find out about it.
Look forward to reading Elliot's story and the stuff we're going to be talking about with Michael Cox today as well. He's done a piece on Bielsa and why he might not be as influential as we think. But we'll get to all that in due course. In the meantime, get to theathletic.com/LeedsPod and pay just £1 a month for 12 months. New subscriber offer only. Head to theathletic.com/LeedsPod. To Arsenal then, and the question that you posed last week when Amy Lawrence was on as a guest. Michael, I enjoyed your question. Arsenal, are they any good? They're not, are they?
She should have just said no. It would have been much quicker. But they're not, are they?
I think she wanted to say no, but she was just conscious of the fact that we had a podcast to fill, and also it would be much harder work for Dan to piece together if she went on for 10 minutes. But she said pretty much what we saw on Sunday, which is that there is a sort of slight loss of patience going on down there, I think, which is understandable when you look at the team. I'm not sure what they're supposed to be or what Arteta thinks they're going to be longer term. And I can't see anything beyond the defensive structure, which in all honesty wasn't particularly good against Leeds. I can't see anything beyond that in his plan. One of our Arsenal writers was saying to me after the game, they almost seem to be happier with 10 players on the pitch, because with only 10 players, there was a license to sit deep and a license to defend and try and see Leeds off, and none of the pressure to actually look like an attacking unit or an attacking force. Yeah, they're not a peak Arsenal side. They're not a vintage Arsenal side at all, but they still do have quality players. I mean, Aubameyang up front, who barely touched the ball with a couple of exceptions and only two chances of note, neither of which he really got hold of. I think for Leeds, after the Palace and the Leicester game, they were back to doing what they do well and to being good in the areas that they need to be good in. So the man marking was decent. The high press was very effective. They were borderline clinical with their chances, but the post and Leno was between everything. And I felt at the end of the game that they were very unlucky. I know on paper it says 25 shots on goal, no goals, 0-0 draw, and a bit of a wasted opportunity. But I did think that the margins were ridiculously fine, and that actually it was 0-0 that should have finished about 3 or 4-0.
What did you make of our defending? Because even though we were well on top and had the chances to win it, they did still have a couple of quite good chances and did get in behind on occasion.
I think that was inevitable once they went down to 10 and also once they got Saka on to the left-hand side, who was really dangerous in the second half and much more of a threat than Willian. And there was that period in the game, last 15, 20 minutes, where Leeds were starting to gamble and risk everything. And there were a few misplaced passes, a couple from Robin Koch in particular, that did put them in positions of danger, did give Arsenal a chance, and brought that brilliant save from Elie from Saka in the period, you know, that chance that might have won the game for Arsenal, even though they didn't deserve it in any way. But I felt that over, you know, most of the game and up until that point, it was neat and tidy, and Arsenal weren't really getting in behind too often. They were seeing very little inside the box. They were finding it really difficult to play out from the back, and Xhaka and Ceballos, the midfield too, just under constant pressure because of the way that Leeds were leaning on them, because of the way that Leeds were cutting off the passing lanes and doing what Bielsa needs them to do. And I thought it was really interesting that when he spoke last week, you know, he went on for 15, 20 minutes about his defensive record or Leeds' defensive record, which always tells you that he's got something he wants to say. It always tells you that there's something in his head that he feels the need to talk about. And whether or not he was concerned about the record or whether or not he was just taking umbrage with the amount of discussion about the goals that had been conceded, he clearly felt that it was something he had to focus on. But he said penalties I can't control, set pieces and so on are more difficult to control and don't really relate to the structure of the team as we play. But the one thing he did highlight was the press. He said, when we press well, high up the pitch, we defend well. When we don't, and when we let the opposition set themselves in our half, then we don't defend well. And I thought you saw that on Sunday. I thought the press was really effective. And because of that, Arsenal were no real threat.
I do wonder if there's a touch of maybe the Solskjaer's a little bit about Arteta, the whole favourite son, not maybe quite up to the job, but I guess that one will be borne out in time. And I guess the other way to look at this is, were Arsenal bad or were Leeds good? And you've kind of hit upon it there, Phil, in what Bielsa said. If we press well from the front, we tend to do okay.
A mixture of both, I think. Leeds have played very well against Liverpool and against Manchester City, but in periods of those games, you know, both of those teams looked very impressive and looked dangerous. I didn't feel that we were getting that from Arsenal at all. And something tells me that management for Arteta has been quite a bit more difficult than he maybe expected. I think he would have hoped that coming in as Guardiola's former assistant and the experience he'd had there and being able to watch Guardiola on the job would have given him a leg up and would have allowed him to have made a pretty quick start at Arsenal. But I don't think you've seen vast improvement there. And even if he knows what he's doing or knows what he wants to do, it isn't really coming to the fore. And yeah, I thought Leeds were excellent in the main. I did think they played really well. They comfortably deserved to win that game. Like Bielsa said, dominated for an hour and then for the last half hour dominated even more. And it was the crossbar, it was the post, it was the post again. It was that great save from Leno, from Stuart Dallas. And it's annoying to come away from a game like that with a point rather than three. But I suspect it matters less this season and in this division than it would have done last season when you're chasing the top two and you really, really do feel the impact of every result that doesn't quite go for you.
Every week we do set you up for a fall because we ask you to pick a one to watch.
Every week I walk straight into it as well, yeah.
And last week you picked Pablo Hernandez, who spent this game in the stands. And Michael, I think you correctly called a late injury would happen.
I did. I cut it down within about a second of Phil saying it, quite rightly so. Yeah. How did he get on in the stands?
I had a fabulous afternoon, I think, yeah. You did say that as soon as I said, yeah, interested to see what his demeanour's like, what his body language is like, what he's like when he comes on, if he comes on. You said, yeah, he'll get a muscle injury and look forward to discussing that next week, which is exactly as it is. I mean, it'll be good when Hernandez is back involved because I think we still need to know with him, you know, whether or not this issue with Bielsa has been swept aside and been dealt with and all is present and correct, and we will hear from Bielsa before the third part of the show today, so hopefully get some insight into that. But I think as the season goes on, you start to realise that actually, irrespective of Bielsa's attitude or Hernandez's fitness, he is starting to slip back in the pecking order, really. I mean, Rodrigo was so good when he came on Sunday that I think there was an argument that Bielsa could perhaps have made that sub a little bit earlier and you know, just let him loose at the point at which Arsenal were down to 10 and were about to sit back. But he looks like a class act and I think looks better and better value at £27 million every time he plays. He could be a huge player over the next two or three years. And I thought Rafinha on the right for his full debut, there was a lot to like about his performance. Some of it would have been apparent at the time, some of it possibly not. But I watched back through the whole 90 minutes to focus on him specifically at the start of the week. And the interplay, the kind of understanding of Bielsa's tactics, the speed of thought and the link up with Matthijs Kleek and others, and also the variation in his position, doing what Hernandez likes to do, which is drift inside and get into the centre circle, get into the pocket in front of the box. It was all there. And I think, again, £70 million, that could prove an absolute bargain if he, over the long term, he's anything like he looks so far.
I was going to ask, actually, with Rafinha, with the positions he was taking up, is he now a replacement for Pablo as well, do you think, as a central player? Do you think he's got the ability to play in there? It was notable, I thought, that he was cutting in a lot more than Costa, who tends to stick on the wing.
Yeah, it's always been slightly different from side to side with Leeds. On the left, you've got Harrison, who really, really likes to hug the touchline and stay very wide and give Leeds as much width as he can. And Costa is a little bit more like that. But as we saw with Hernandez in the periods where he played on the right in the Championship, and again with Rafinha on Sunday, it's that drifting role where you can play wide and you can get at the fullback, but equally you pop up in areas where the opposition aren't necessarily expecting you to go. And I think because Arsenal don't have a man-marking system, when Rafinha was drifting and was roaming, he was quite hard to pick up and quite hard to keep track of. In terms of playing centrally, we've asked Bielsa about this, and he says that at the moment he considers Rafinha to be either a right winger or a left winger, essentially at his best when he plays out wide. But he has spoken a little bit about trying to convert him to the point where he could be a number 10 and where he could play centrally from the off. And that sort of feeds back into the variation that he looks at, or the adaptability, versatility in every player. So I think it's something he will look at. But I have to say that if Rodrigo is fit and available and Cleek is in anything like top form, I don't think anybody has a look in those two positions.
And a quick word for Bamford as well, who's made himself almost undroppable now. Sort of generally speaking, his performances have been outstanding.
Yeah, and I thought that was a quality header from him, the one off the post. You know, it not quite precision placed, but pretty much the only position where it was going to beat Leno. I'm not sure Leno would have got there if it had sneaked inside. And there was the other header that he didn't quite get hold of when Rafinha stood that cross up for him. But you're right. I mean, it's already got to the point where I don't think any of us are thinking of Rodrigo as a nine at the moment. I don't think any of us are looking at him in that mould. I don't think any of us would make the argument for him to play up front instead of Bamford, because if you were to do that, suddenly the structure of the team changes and potentially falls apart. And I'm amazed really at how quickly we've come round to the point of discussing Bamford for England. But I think on the basis of his form so far versus the form of other English forwards and versus the form of other people who are making the England squad, it's a legitimate discussion and a legitimate debate. And I'm with you. I think the way it's going, I see him playing the entire season up front. I don't think there's going to be much of a challenge to his position, and I don't think Bielsa wants there to be much of a challenge.
I think it's probably helped him now that it feels like for the first time in his Leeds career, he's actually got a bit of credit in the bank. It felt like he was never quite living up to his price tag, and then we were creating a load of chances that he misses. Whereas now, even when he's missed the odd half chance as against Arsenal, you could go, oh, well, but he's scored recently and he's fine. Whereas I think before there was that clamour to he's not good enough, he needs replacing. He's now shown over a period of games that he is good enough, so everyone's willing to give him a bit more time.
As well, I don't feel like chances are passing him by. You know, like the volley in the first half that Leno saved, that was a good effort from a difficult chance, and it's not as if he's fluffing those. He's kind of forcing saves. He's stretching defences. He's doing all the right things. I think he's always had credit in the bank when it comes to the club, you know, and Bielsa and the players around him. I've never ever felt particularly wavering faith when it comes to Bielsa. I've never really felt either that there's been any frustration in the dressing room about his finishing or the lack of goals. They do really seem to have his back. But in terms of the public, you're absolutely right. No crowds at the stadiums at the moment. But I think if there were, there would be little in the way of discussion about his position, because I think he picks himself.
Regarding the Arsenal game then, it's normal under the circumstances where you've had a red card, you would say the game turned on it, but it didn't really, because Bielsa said we were on top for 60 minutes, then we were even more on top for 30 minutes. It just continued to facilitate our attacking when they started dropping further and further back. But let's talk about the red card and its influence on the game. And wasn't that just, it was just stupid from Pepe?
I felt so at the time. We watched it on VAR, and as soon as you saw it, you said that is a red card. You know, he's going to get sent off for that. And you always end up straying into the argument about, was there that much contact? Did Alioski need to go down go down like he did? But it was all fairly irrelevant, because, you know, Pepe did what he did, and there was never going to be any other outcome. And you always look with interest to see what your coaches say at the end of the game. And Bielsa was never going to say anything about it, because Bielsa always just says, look, the decision was the decision, and that's the end of it. But Arteta was so visibly furious with Pepe that there was no attempt by him whatsoever to say Alioski tried it on, Alioski got him sent off. Kieran Tierney had a bit of a half-hearted go at Alioski after the game, although it seemed as if he was looking for Arsenal players to drag him away before he'd got anywhere near him. But none of the rest of the Arsenal players seemed particularly unhappy with Alioski. And even if you watch the build-up to the red card and the little tangles between Pepe and Alioski, there's not enough in it to justify doing that. There just isn't. I think whatever Pepe says to Arteta about his motivation for headbutting him, Arteta will say to him, you cannot get that wound up by that small amount of niggle, really. And people sort of said, somebody asked Bielsa afterwards, is Alioski good at getting in at the head of other players? Is he good at winding people up? to which you suspect the answer is absolutely. But I don't think it took very much. I think any of us could have done that on Sunday. And as I say, you defer to Arteta, because when Arteta is so obviously angry with him, and so angry that he couldn't bring himself to say anything other than it's just unacceptable. You know, he was obviously restraining himself because he was worried that he was going to go too far and go over the top on Pepe. But again, it's a bit symptomatic of a lot of what's going on at Arsenal. A £72 million player who at the moment looks like a complete waste of money and doesn't look like... He looks like if you tried to sell him tomorrow, you'd be lucky to make half of your cash back. And I think that's the problem at Arsenal at the moment. It isn't clicking. It isn't coming together. They're not peaking. They're not playing as well as they can. And I think he's got a very big job on there, Arteta.
And the social media abuse that followed in the wake of that, Phil, not really a Leeds problem, was it? It was more an Arsenal thing. How come we've got joint statements coming out?
I think Arsenal wanted to address it because the racist abuse of Pepe was shocking, although kind of what you come to expect on Twitter. And, you know, there was abuse directed towards Alioski as well, threats against his family, homophobic slurs. I'm in two minds about this. I mean, on the one hand, you do, I think, have to highlight it, and you do have to challenge it publicly, and you do have to make people aware of the fact that people are watching, you know, and that you are conscious of this stuff, that you are looking for this stuff, that you will deal with it. But I sometimes wonder as well whether the people involved are worth the publicity. It occurs to me sometimes that when you flag up the fact that you are going to go looking for these people, it gives them the chance to close accounts, which is pretty much what happened on Twitter on Monday morning. I mean, there's a much broader issue here, which is about the way that social media companies do, and more to the point, don't effectively force people to identify themselves on their sites. I mean, you might use bookmakers accounts like I do, and if you want to sign up for them these days, you have to supply passport or a driving license, some form of formal identification, which I assume is to do with money laundering and so on, so that they know exactly who you are. But I do think it's probably time that with the right data checks, there was some form of regulation for Twitter or Instagram whereby people who'd sign up have to provide details of who they are, where they live, how essentially you can contact them or pin them down if you need to in situations like that, where somebody like Pepe is being racially abused or where Alioski is having homophobic abuse thrown at him. And it just seems completely ridiculous that you can go through this over and over again, and it's the same routine over and over again, and there doesn't seem to be any accountability for Twitter or Instagram or whoever else when it comes to actually making sure that if the police want to knock on somebody's door and ask questions about this, then they can. And I don't know what the outcome will be of the abuse that was aimed at Pepe and Alioski. I don't know if this will lead to police action or to charges or any convictions, but it's seriously depressing. And the thing is, you know that it won't be that long before it comes around in another game with other players.
But away from that bad stuff, all in all, a pretty decent weekend for Leeds. Would have been nice to get the three, but we'll take the one.
Yeah, especially after the games against Leicester and Palace and the questions about the defence. The structure was much better against Arsenal. It was much more like a Bielsa team. And I think, all in all, they will be very happy with that performance.
Robin Cockfield, you've been writing about him this week, and it's good to see that he's settled in at Elland Road. He's starting to put in some really solid performances defensively. Frightened the life out of me slightly in that game against Arsenal when he was further forward than Calvin Phillips, but enjoyed it a bit.
He doesn't half like carrying the ball out, and actually, you know, distribution-wise, seems every bit as happy to have a go with passing as Ben White was last season, and actually as the rest of the defence around him are. And actually, you know, some of the searching balls from him are very effective. There were just the one or two risks, particularly late on, which did play Leeds into trouble. But for what it's worth, I think Bielsa would, in the way that he quite often takes things on the chin for the purposes of playing to his style, I think he'd be quite happy to accept that from time to time. Yeah, it was a joint piece that I did with Rafa Honigstein at The Athletic that we've been planning for quite a while, and we wanted to look into not only Cock's background, but also the manner in which Leeds scouted him, because I was aware that, a little bit like White, they'd been on the trail of him for a long, long time, and even though it felt like a fallback after the offers for White were not back from Brighton, the nuts and bolts of the transfer had to a large extent been done already, and he was a player who Leeds were very, very keen on. They were just honest enough to say to him, look, we can't do both you and Ben White. We don't have the budget. And also, if we don't get promoted, because it was May time that they started speaking to him with Freiburg's permission. If we don't get promoted equally, we won't have the cash to do this deal. So I got in touch with Otter, and Otter was saying that the first time he was aware of Koch was after a game between Hannover and Kaiserslautern in January 2017. So, you know, the best part of 4 years ago. And before he even came to Leeds, he was on the staff at Middlesbrough at the time. And they'd actually gone to watch a different player. They'd gone to watch Martin Harnig, who was striker for Hannover. But as so often happens with scouting reports, or as happens with scouts who have their eyes open and have quite a broad mind, they noticed Koch, they noticed the way that he played, and they mentioned him in dispatches, saying that defensively he was very good, his positioning was pretty astute, but more to the point, his distribution was quality, and that he was somebody who looked very happy on the ball. And Otter has essentially tracked him ever since, you know, it's kind of on the back burner and without ever making a formal move for him. And obviously after that, Koch moved to Freiburg in the Bundesliga and developed there. But it made you realise that he was somebody that they'd been looking at for a long, long time. And even in May, at the point where they were still to get promoted and where everybody was clamouring for Leeds to sign White on a permanent deal, they sent a presentation to Koch with Freiburg's permission. You know, that was agreed with Freiburg because they knew the likelihood was that Koch was going to go. Basically to fill him in on Bielsa's tactics, how Bielsa saw him fitting into the team. There were videos in which there were clips married between games that Leeds had played and games that Freiburg had played to show him that a lot of what he did at Freiburg would be replicated in Bielsa's team, but also to kind of accentuate the differences as well. But it was interesting getting into finding out a little bit about his background as well. He grew up in a small village in southwest Germany, and he wasn't an academy player. You know, he wasn't an elite academy player. He played for Eintracht Trier, who were a low-level German club in his younger years. And actually, you know, one of his friends that we spoke to said that in their opinion, when he was young, his brother Louis, who now plays, I think, at an amateur level in Germany, was seen as the better of the two. You know, that they felt that there was more talent there. And it was only when Koch first broke into the Eintracht Trier first team, but also started to be offered regional trials by the German FA, that the penny started to drop about what could happen with him. But, you know, people might not know that his father, Harry, played as a defender for Kaiserslautern and was part of the team, the last Kaiserslautern team to win the Bundesliga title in 1998. And when Koch moved to Kaiserslautern from Eintracht Trier, his friend Simon Berg was saying that he was very anxious not to feed off his dad's reputation and not to look for any favours because of who his dad was. So he lived in what Bell called an absolute pit, close to the club, a high-rise, really scruffy high-rise, where nobody knew who he was. And with the exception of the postman, nobody ever recognised him. And Koch was quite happy that way because he liked to be under the radar. And Berg spoke about, you know, his time they went out drinking in town, went to sports bar to watch a game, and there were some Kaiserslautern fans in there, and one of them said to Koch, "You look like Robin Koch." And Koch said to him, "Oh, I get the, you know, people
get all the time.
People mistake me for him quite a lot." You know, so I think quite a low key guy, but also very switched on and very ambitious in his own way. And his friend Simon was saying that he spoke to Koch after the Liverpool game, which was obviously quite a difficult debut for him. There was the penalty, which was a very, very harsh decision, but then there was the corner where he lost Van Dijk and Van Dijk scored. And I think all round just a bit wobbly and a bit shaky. And his friend said he spoke to him after the game and Koch just said, "Look, it's one of those things. I'm not going to think about it too much. I'll just let it go and move on." And he said that's really the biggest thing about Koch, is that aside from his talent, he's got a great, great temperament and somebody who never lets an awful lot rattle him.
Thoughts on him so far, Michael?
I've been quite impressed. We've seen from Bielsa's system, it's very difficult to come in and learn it quickly. And that's why Bielsa tends to like people to be here for 6 months, to the extent where you think maybe he's frozen them out. Someone like Pervada, you almost started to doubt whether or not he was ever going to make it. Koch has had to come in and play because of Ben White's departure. And I guess to make the Ben White comparison, the Premier League is not a forgiving place to try and learn a system. Whereas Ben White maybe will have got away with certain things in the Championship. It's a completely different calibre of player. But overall, I think particularly when you look at the money we've spent on him, you'd have to say he looks like quite a bargain so far.
And you look at him as an international, you've got Llorente, who we've not seen yet, but I'm sure we will do in due course, Rodrigo, Rafinha as well. It shows the appeal and the allure of Bielsa in being able to bring these players to a newly promoted Premier League side.
It does. And if you think about the presentation that they sent to Koch, it landed in May at a time when they were saying to him, look, we might sign somebody else. And actually, if we don't go up, we probably won't sign you at all. So in those circumstances, there's always the risk that a player's going to say, well, you know, minus any promise or minus any guarantee, I don't really see why I should engage in this. But Koch watched through the footage, he watched through the presentation and was totally sold by it. I think really fascinated by what he saw. And what it meant was that when it came round to the point where Leeds finally moved for him and made an offer to Freiburg, Alter kind of said there was no way for Freiburg to play us off against anybody else. There was no way for them to pretend that another club were going to pay more, and Koch was in two minds about where to go, because Koch had made it clear that he wanted to come to Leeds and he wanted to play for Bielsa. And there was very little bartering when it came to the £30 million fee. And, you know, I agree with Michael. I think he does look really good value. And I think it's probably presumptuous to assume that White would have been any better in these games. I think you're right. As exceptionally as he was in the Championship, you do get away with a little bit more there. I think Leeds as a team probably got away with more in the Championship than they are getting away within the Premier League, even though defensively they were extremely good under Bielsa. But it just, I felt at the time that at £30 million compared to what Leeds were talking about spending on White, and given that they seemed to be very similar in terms of what they were good at and what they were strong at, it felt like very, very good value, £30 million. And I know that Alter thinks that for a fact.
It feels to me like we've got Rafinha almost thrown in for free for the price of Ben White, which when you look at it that way, does seem a better deal.
Well, this is the thing, and that's often how the window works. If you spend big on certain players, the budget is gone unless your owner or somebody else is prepared to put cash in and to help stretch things a little bit further.
Jay-Z.
Jay-Z or Dua Lipa or any of the big music acts who have suddenly become big Leeds fans overnight. But you're right. I don't think anybody could suggest that Rafinha and Koch for a total of £30 million versus Ben White for £30 million is not a good trade. I think Leeds have done very, very well out of those two fees.
Returning to Bielsa then and his nomination for FIFA Coach of the Year. Across the world, the whole of planet Earth, five nominees. He's in there along with Jurgen Klopp and some other nomarchs.
Yeah, Hansi Flick hasn't done much in the last year.
Never heard of any of them.
And definitely isn't going to win this without getting out of bed. I mean, that looks absolutely nailed on if FIFA's previous awards are anything to go by. I suspect we are biased, yeah? So I think you can easily make the argument for Bielsa being on that list. And I always say that his influence at Leeds goes so far beyond results. It isn't just the results and it isn't just the league table. It's things like the improvement of individual players and the kind of vast enhancement of a squad that looked bang average mid-table group before he came in. There's the engagement with the city. There's the, you know, his reputation and just the kind of unanimous respect that he has at a club and with a fan base who, if we're being honest, don't unanimously respect very many people. You know, I think find it much easier to despise people, particularly given the way things have gone over the past 15, 16 years. But I think he's worth his place on that list. I'm well aware that others disagree, and it did seem to cause a little bit of upset on Wednesday morning, as it was always likely to do. But I think what everybody can probably agree on is that Bielsa in the list ahead of Dean Smith seems about the sensible run of things.
Journalists of a particular stripe didn't necessarily agree with your take on that. I mean, my favourite take on this was when this got carried through to its logical extension, and one particular journalist, who I won't name drop on here, but was annoyed that Tony Pulis probably wouldn't get nominated for If He Does a Good Job next year at Sheffield Wednesday. I mean, how annoying is that, Michael?
It does seem to have irked people who just... There seems to be a number of people who just don't like Bielsa for... I can't quite put my finger on why.
I'll tell you why it is. It's because he's Argentinian, I think, and he's seen as a hipster's kind of choice.
I don't think it's Argentinian. I think it is the hipster factor. No,
I think it's because he's not English as well. There is part of it.
Which is quite ironic, isn't it, given that the criticism of him being on the list was that FIFA would never have nominated anybody English, even though I find it really hard to imagine them sitting in Zurich saying, well, we're not having Chris Wilder because he's a bit... He's a bit Sheffield and he's a bit Steel City and so on. It isn't going to work like that.
Bear in mind, there was an English nominee in the women's category as well. But this particular journalist who got really annoyed didn't bother to check that.
I honestly think with Bielsa, it's the fact that if you're up close to it and you see it from the perspective that we do, and not just the football in plain sight, but versus the absolute shambles that Leeds have been for 15 years, I add this down as probably the most difficult job in European club football, not because what you've been asked to aspire to is in any way comparable with, say, Klopp at Liverpool and Guardiola. You know, Guardiola gets it in the neck every year when he doesn't win the Champions League, and he does have a quality, expensive squad over there, but there are a number of them through Europe, and you know, there is always the chance that you're going to get done on any given day. You know, there's no leeway, there's no, you know, there's very little tolerance for poor results over there. But at Leeds, you were talking 15 years of just decay and decline and meandering, and the frustration that built up in the stands, and the players I've spoken to over the years who said you could feel it every time things went wrong. You know, you were getting hammered for your mistakes, but you were also getting hammered for the mistakes that had been made in seasons where you weren't even there and that were nothing to do with you, because everybody was so downtrodden, everybody had been beaten for so long that it was just pure underlying annoyance and dissatisfaction. And he's completely owned this job right from the start. You know, from that Stoke City game onwards, okay, it didn't happen in season one and there was that real dip at the worst possible time, and then the defeat to Derby in the playoffs. But I almost feel it's a bit like a boxer. They always say you find out about a boxer when they lose and what they do next. That what it was like in season two, win the division by 10 points, be by a street the best team in it. And again, to go back to it, with a squad in the main that when he came in was 13th, 14th, 15th, and no better than that. You know,
does any of that count for anything when he can't speak English in his post-match interviews, though? That's the important thing for many people.
I think people do underestimate the absolute oil tanker that he has managed to turn around at Leeds. It's been an impossible job for people. People like Neil Warnock, Brian McDermott, promotion specialists, have come in and got absolutely nowhere near it. Like, they're so far away from achieving it. And Bielsa almost instantly did it, and then he's built on that. And I think if you look at the job that Chris Wilder has done, I guess you could maybe make an argument that he should have been on some shortlist at some point, because he has dragged them up through several divisions and they had a good year last season. But then I guess it is manager of the year, and unfortunately that year includes this season for him, which leaves them bottom of the league with 1 point from nine. So you can't really put someone in on the basis that they're at the moment looking like relegating a side.
I agree about Wilder. You shouldn't underestimate what he's done at Sheffield United. I think the issue when it comes to FIFA's shortlist is that they're far more likely to focus on trophies and tangible success than they are to, you know, kind of lean towards a manager who is vastly, vastly overachieved, but whose team are 7th, 8th, 9th, mid-table in the end, as much as it's very, very high performance from Sheffield United. I think FIFA always lean that way, and I don't think anybody should be losing sleep over this, because it is just a FIFA award. And it's when we speak to Bielsa about this, I absolutely guarantee you that he'll be completely nonplussed and he will say something like, well, it's not even anything to do with me anyway. It's all about the players, and can we please move on? And that will probably go for the other coaches who are on the list as well. But I've always felt that if Leeds are not your club, or Bielsa isn't your sort of coach, or if you're detached from it in a way that makes it seem as if everything up here is inflated, or everything about his reputation or the coverage of him is excessive or unduly positive, then I suppose over time you probably would take against him and you probably would get tired of it. But I do think if you look at it objectively, and maybe we don't, you know, I don't know whether some of us, me included, are too close to properly see his flaws or everything else. But if you are close to it, I do think you see a bit of a genius at work. And I think, and I said earlier, it's not all about results, but the results do back it up. So do the performances. So does the improvement of individual players. And I will constantly find the sort of scepticism about him, or the kind of dislike of him, fairly baffling. Because to me, he's the sort of guy who makes football incredibly interesting. And there aren't that many people in football who do that.
English football shouldn't be about interesting. It should be about graft and set pieces and getting up top early.
And pints with the lads. That's what it should be all about.
Well, that's what he hates, though, isn't it? He's not a drinker. He's not big on set pieces. It doesn't seem to me like he would ever... I mean, I might be completely wrong on this, but I cannot imagine him losing sleep over corners and free kicks and so on. I almost imagine him seeing them as peripheral, annoying parts of the game which break the flow of it up and stop you dominating in open play and everything else. You know, it's just fluid, attractive football. And I think it'll be a big, big challenge going forward for any manager to, I guess, plug into the fan base at Leeds in the way he has. I don't care who comes after him and how high profile they are, or how expensive they are, or what they've done previously. They're going to have to deliver on a very, very high level to be seen in the way that Bielsa is seen. And that, I think, is the key aspect to him.
Well, let's find out just how special he is then, and speak to Michael Cox from The Athletic, aka Zonal Markin. Hi, Michael.
Hello.
Welcome to the Phil Hayes Show. So does Bielsa deserve his place on this FIFA coaches list then? Tell us about that.
I wasn't too shocked to see his name on there. I think his achievements last season, I think the impact he's made at Leeds means that, he was always likely to be in the conversation. I know some people have had some fun with that nomination, but it's always a bit of a slightly random list, isn't it? I mean, it's difficult to kind of keep tabs of every manager who's performing across every league in the world, especially when you go into the second tier, as of course Bielsa was last season. But yeah, I didn't have that much of a problem with it, no.
No, we said the same earlier, Michael. We thought that as well. It seemed like a reasonable choice, to say the least. But a lot of people, I think, will have been interested by the piece you did on Wednesday that was looking at what people perceive really as Bielsa's influence, particularly his influence on other coaches and the way that they've created their teams, their kind of philosophy when it comes to coaching and tactics and strategies and everything else. It was fascinating, I thought, and particularly your view that it's not so much that Bielsa's been influential as the fact that he's been unique as a coach, which I think you were saying is something that quite often gets overlooked.
Yeah, I mean, I view Bielsa almost quite differently from a lot of the media coverage. And I thought there was a massive contradiction that wasn't really addressed when people spent the summer, you know, saying Bielsa's the most influential coach, he shaped the modern game. And then Leeds went to Anfield and they played, as everyone could see, a completely different style from anyone we'd seen in the Premier League, certainly last couple of seasons, probably ever, to be honest. So I think there's a huge contradiction there on the idea he shaped the modern game when he plays in such a different way. And I think it's, you know, this word influence, I think, is kind of grown in popularity, and it's almost like any coach who's interesting or different is somehow influential. I don't think he is that influential in the grand scheme of things, because particularly without the ball, he plays this man-marking scheme that, if any other Premier League club tried that, I think their players would say, what on earth is this? I've never played that before in my life. So, yeah, I just think the concept of influence is overstated in this regard. I think what he is actually much more interesting than being influential. He is a complete outsider. He is completely unique. I think calling him influential kind of misses the point.
Why do you think that system works at Leeds then?
Well, I mean, it's the system that Bielsa really has used, I mean, certainly for as long as I've been kind of writing about him tactically, which goes back 10 years now to his work with Chile before the 2010 World Cup. I mean, it's so unfamiliar to almost every other club that I just think it needs work on the training ground. It sometimes needs a bit of time to click into gear, although I don't think that was necessarily the case at Leeds United. It's almost about players kind of reprogramming their brains, I think. It's just a completely different way of doing things. And yeah, the managers who are commonly cited as disciples of Bielsa, someone like Simeone or Pochettino, I mean, they use completely zone-based defensive systems. They get into two banks of four, and sometimes, okay, they press high up the pitch from that. But there's absolutely none of the man marking you see from a Bielsa side. And really, you probably have to go back to, you know, football from the 1970s or 1980s to really find teams who were playing that way. So I'm not sure that it's, you know, him being influential. I think it's, if anything, he's taken a system we haven't seen in top level football for a long time and applied it to the modern game, which I don't think any other coach has really done.
Do you think he's too singular to copy? So the man marking for one thing, but the extremes that he kind of goes to with the repetition and the style of coaching. I mean, we were chatting about this yesterday, and I was saying that I spoke to Andoni Iraola, who played for him at Bilbao, and I was speaking to him specifically about the mother ball sessions that Bielsa does in midweek. And Iraola was saying that they were hugely effective, and he remembers them very clearly, but that he's now gone into coaching in Spain, he would never try to replicate it. I think in part because a lot of players probably wouldn't tolerate it from a coach who wasn't Bielsa and didn't have that kind of reputation and aura around him. But also because it is so hard and it is so exacting that actually for a lot of coaches, it wouldn't feel like the right thing to do as part of your midweek preparation.
Yeah, absolutely. I must say, actually, I had no idea that Iraola had gone into coaching until I saw you talking about it. I remember when I went over to Bilbao about 8 or 9 years ago to write about Bielsa then, and he was the right back. And exactly the kind of player you can imagine being a coach. But yeah, I mean, it does seem to me like players find Bielsa fascinating and inspirational and almost a bit of a guru and someone who can kind of open up their minds to different methods. You know, I mean, one of the coaches that Bielsa was influenced by heavily was Van Gaal. And Van Gaal's quite a bit different, I think, in the sense that he really liked working with young players because he said he struggled to work with older players because he couldn't convince them to change their way of thinking. And I know Bielsa as well does like working with young players. But I said Bielsa probably has had more of an impact in terms of he can get players who have been around for a while and just change their mentality. And he can kind of, yeah, almost re-educate players in a particular way of playing. And I think that general process, the general kind of opening up players' minds, I'd say is more, to use that word again, that is maybe more influential than his actual tactical approach, which hasn't been replicated by the likes of Pochettino and Simeone, who, one, did play under Bielsa, and two, are very highly regarded coaches. But their system really is completely different.
You talked in the article about the tactical simplicity of it in some ways. Do you think that's why it's maybe worked at Leeds with players who, even as Leeds fans, we would maybe thought were kind of limited to the Championship in terms of their overall standard?
Yeah, I think there is an argument for that. And I think there's also an argument for the fact that it's such a strict system that, you know, there's other managers. I mean, Zeman for Roma in the 1990s was often accused of this because it's so prescriptive in its kind of attacking intent that sometimes when there's creative players of a higher technical quality, maybe you either lose something from them or they just don't fit into the system. So I was interested what would happen with Rodrigo, who obviously came in, I mean, plays up front for Spain, a really high quality player. And I think it's interesting that he's taken a while to kind of get into the team. Although actually, I think he's done really well in a couple of games. I mean, the game against City, I thought he helped not necessarily change the game because I think Leeds were on top, but certainly in the last 20 minutes, I thought he was a really key factor in making sure that Leeds were on top and probably should have won that game. So yeah, it's difficult to judge that from Leeds because they didn't bring in a host of big names in the summer like some of the other promoted clubs have done in the last couple of years. But probably the one player I think you could call a little bit of a star seems to be getting up to speed and getting on board with the type of football he wants.
Just a final thought, Michael, given that there really aren't many teams that you can compare directly to Bielsa's own, and given your view that there aren't actually many coaches who replicate what he does, and in terms of the question of influence, you'll hear Guardiola say quite often and quite openly that he regards Bielsa as the best coach in the world. What do you think he means by that then?
Well, it's difficult to say. I mean, I think what Bielsa's done with Leeds is a great example of a really highly established coach going to a side who weren't near the top of their league. They weren't even in the top flight and taking them from the second tier to seemingly going to be very comfortable in the Premier League without any stars. And it's difficult really to find any examples of another coach who's done that in recent years. So I tend to be slightly cautious with kind of calling Bielsa the best coach because at the end of the day, there are coaches who have won a lot more than him. But yeah, there are very few coaches who have taken over a side and transformed them, you know, pretty quickly. I know they didn't get promotion the first season, but there was a huge impact he had on a club who, as I don't need to tell you, had not been at this level for a long time. So I think Guardiola clearly admires him very much as a man and as a coach. And I think there's also something to be said for, you know, it's a great story. Bielsa is a great story. The fact that Guardiola went to, you know, his ranch to visit him in 2005 or whatever and was inspired by him is a wonderful thing to say. And there's also the fact that it doesn't really work for Guardiola to be saying that the best coach in the world is Klopp or Mourinho or, you know, one of the other high profile coaches. I think it helps if he can call someone like Bielsa, who with respect to Leeds and not threatening Manchester City in terms of their league position, I think he's probably more comfortable saying that Bielsa is the best coach in the world rather than someone who's going to finish ahead of him in the league.
Through the magic of editing, we've now broken off and enjoyed Marcelo Bielsa's Thursday press conference, Phil. And quite a lot to be said this week then as we head towards Everton at the weekend.
Yeah, a lot on Maradona today, which is to be expected. And Bielsa had a huge amount to say about him. I think he falls into the category of pretty much everybody else in Argentina and actually most people in football in general, people who have any sort of interest in the game, that he thinks of Maradona as he's put it, an immeasurable player. And I totally agree with this when he said everything he did as a footballer had a beauty that cannot be matched. And I think that's totally right. He saw Maradona as an artist. He saw him as just a unique talent. And I asked him at one point, you know, what his perception was of the pressure that Maradona had on him in Argentina when he was playing, but also in Naples when he was at Napoli, where the whole thing was predicated on him being an absolute superstar. The Scudettos that they won, it was, you know, you can never say it's entirely down to him, but it felt that way, and I think it was seen that way. And you know, anybody who watched the documentary, brilliant documentary last year about him, would have, I think, probably been, even though they knew about his lifestyle and everything else, would have been quite shocked at the way in which he basically had no private life at all. He was everybody else's property. He was just constantly surrounded by cameras and hangers-on and people close to him. Almost the sort of lifestyle that you can't imagine anybody really enjoying or coping with. But Bielsa was saying that players like Maradona, players with unique brilliance, as he put it, don't play with pressure, don't feel pressure, don't know what it is to have pressure on them, because pressure implies that you struggle in some way, or it's detrimental, or it has some negative effect. And he said, if you look at Maradona and the way he played and what he did, there's a player there that was just calm and completely in touch with his own talent and his own unique ability. Somebody who would not have struggled, because at no point was there ever any reason to. He was just too good in all respects. So really interesting to hear his thoughts. And I think the depth that he went into in speaking about him tells you how much Bielsa respected him.
These days in 2020, we can attract Argentinians with global renown and worldwide reputations to Elland Road. Nearly got there with Maradona in the 1980s. We have our own little unique bit of history with him. If Bill Fotherby had got his way, he might have even pulled on the white shirt, or maybe not.
Yeah, and Sheffield United had a dabble as well. I was looking at some cuttings on Twitter today from down in the West Midlands, talking about Birmingham trying to sign Maradona. You wonder how much of it was ever legit and how much of it just made great headlines. I mean, the 86 World Cup is the first one I remember. I was 5 years old, and I remember with mates of mine when it came around to the final against West Germany, talk, because we were so young and didn't understand football properly, talking about supporting Maradona in the final, and parents saying, "Oh, it's Argentina who are playing in the final. You know, it's not Maradona." But he'd become the team by that point. He'd become this superstar that everybody was hanging on and who the whole tournament was about. And the big regret for me was that in 89, Hearts went a long way into the UEFA Cup and beat Bayern Munich at Tynecastle in the quarterfinals. Lost on aggregate after a really, really tight game in Munich where John Gahoun hit the post, a couple of great chances in that. And the prize for that would have been a semi-final against Maradona's Napoli, which would have been incredible and fantastic experience, potentially seeing him at Tynecastle, and it was never to be. But I think as big an icon as he is in Argentina, it was the Napoli aspect that I always found fascinating. Going there and doing that with that club, again, just carrying them in the way that he seemed completely made to do in the earlier part of his career was just absolutely sensational.
To the weekend then, and what's Bielsa had to say ahead of Everton?
Well, injuries are much the same. Llorente's still out, Hernandez still out, Shackleton still out. I don't think any of these injuries are serious, but we're at the moment not really getting any clear timescale on and when they're likely to ease. So it's going to be much the same as it was. I think there'll probably be a decision to be made on Rodrigo, whether or not he comes into the starting lineup. I thought Dallas actually did very well in midfield, but I think over the longer term, Rodrigo is the player who's going to thrive in that area. He was asked about Everton because Everton have been fairly up and down, or at least that is to say they were very up at the start of the season. They've been slightly down more recently. And in terms of concessions, and we were talking about the defence earlier, they're only one behind Leeds this season. And you know, they have been involved in some gunfights, 5-2 against West Brom, 4-2 against Brighton, even Fulham last weekend, 3-2 win that was closer than it should have been. So this could be fun in games, I think, at Goodison Park. I don't expect them to be overly tight, Everton. I don't think Bielsa will do anything other than go there and attack. And if, I think I said this about Arsenal, but it feels like another 50-50 to me, this. I don't think there's too much in Everton's favour. I think if Leeds play well, they've got every chance over there. But he didn't want to get into the aspects of Everton's defending too much. He said himself, "I spoke about our defending for 20 minutes last week, so I will let you all off lightly."
We were at a bit of a loss to figure out if Arsenal were any good, and I share similar feelings about Everton, because they evidently ship goals, but then on a bad day, so do we. I don't know what to think. Are they good? Are they not? Good start to the season, but it's come off the rails a little bit since. And what do you think?
Ancelotti's one of those as well, that he's generally, this is actually quite a poor job by his standards. He just generally has gone round top club to top club with big budgets and a pretty much a ready-made team. This is slightly different for him, I suppose, in that he's come in and he's trying to actually build something from scratch almost at Everton, albeit they had Calvert-Lewin and Richarlison and people like that there. I don't know if I fancy him against Bielsa. I don't know why. I feel like he's more of a manager to send players out to do a job. Maybe that's been very, very unfair on a man who's won so many trophies, but it almost feels like he won't necessarily be prepared for Bielsa.
Bielsa had a lot to say about him. I don't think they've come up against each other before, and he considers Ancelotti to be right in the top tier of coaches. I think he's very respectful of Ancelotti's success. I think he doesn't see much in the way of weaknesses in Ancelotti's tactical outlook and his strategies. He'll be expecting a very difficult game. But I noticed that against Fulham, they moved to a back three, Everton, having been pretty much the back four all the way through the season. And that would suggest that after the three defeats back-to-back, Southampton, Newcastle and Manchester United, that Ancelotti felt the need to shuffle it up a little bit. They have had injuries as well, injuries to key players. And obviously, if they are going to have a stellar season, guys like James Rodriguez have got to fire, have got to click, have got to be available, have got to play as well as they can. And I think they're going to be a side who, in certain points of this season, as they were at the very beginning, are going to be extremely threatening and extremely difficult to play against. But I also think they'll be a bit patchy. I think you'll have spells where they drop points, and you'll have spells which will pretty much underline why it is that they're not going to be in serious contention for the title.
Are we expecting to see Calvin on Rodriguez, do you think?
I would imagine that, to my mind, was one of the big issues down at Palace, was the fact that when Zaha got going, you didn't have Phillips to marshal the flanks and to sweep up in the way that he does. And, you know, for a lot of the game against Arsenal found that difficult until Saka really started to get a bit of a run on the left and started to find space. It wasn't easy for them to break out either. Rodriguez is the one, and absolutely, Phillips, you know, if that matchup comes, Phillips will have his eyes on him.
Interesting what you were saying then about the tactical changes at this point in the season, and to go back to the things that Bielsa has said about his own system and his conviction in his own system, is that if you start changing the tactics, it undermines your position a little bit as a manager, because does that not transmit to the players that, hang on, I don't quite have this figured out?
I think it depends on how you work as a manager and what your attitude is as a coach. If you're somebody who tends to be versatile and likes the idea of switching tactics, so horses for courses, depending on who you're playing, and just, I guess, being a bit adaptable depending on what the form is like or what individual player's form is like, then it doesn't come as much of a surprise to the dressing room if things do get shuffled up. I think the point Bielsa tries to make is that if he spends 2.5 years drumming into them 4-1-4-1 or 3-3-1-3 against a front two, the patterns of play, the rotation, the overlapping, the underlapping, the absolute aversion to long ball football in the sort of hoofball sense. It's not that Melier and Kessié before him weren't allowed to play long. It was just that long passes, as with Liam Cooper, had to be directed and had to be targeted. You know, they had to be sensible and had to be all about bringing players into play. He would feel that if he suddenly said one day, look, right, we're switching to five at the back, or we're playing with five in midfield, or we're going to break up these tactics, we're going to shuffle it around, then the players would take that as a transmission from him of a bit of a lack of faith in what's going on, perhaps a loss of faith in them, or a loss of faith in his own tactics. For what it's worth, I don't think the players would feel like that. I think they would probably respect the fact that from time to time you do have to be versatile and you do have to shift your thinking slightly, although Bielsa clearly never does. But because of how rigid he is with his style and because of how rigid he is in the way that he manages a squad, he probably is one of those who would be made to look vulnerable by the fact that he seemed to be having doubts in what they've been done before. He is 100% nailed his colours to the mast at Leeds, as he did at previous clubs. And whereas you will get, you know, switches and changes of formation elsewhere, with Bielsa, that will just never happen, with the one exception of adapting depending on what the opposition are playing up front.
I wish we still had Michael Cox on the line, actually, because I should have asked this question to him. But I wonder, because I don't know enough about tactics to answer this question for myself. Three at the back, if they play that against us, with us playing just Bamford up front, one up front, does that not leave two spare men at the back and maybe leave them a little bit underserved in midfield? Because you'd expect, like, Harrison, and let's say it's Rafinha for argument's sake, on the right-hand side on Saturday, that they're going to be pushing onto the wide men. So you've potentially got two defenders spare. Does that not leave them a little bit potentially open in midfield?
Well, this is Bielsa's point, that you should always have an extra centre-back, but never more than one, never less than one either, which is why three against the front two and two against a single man up front. Obviously, if Rodrigo starts, for example, you're going to have him floating, you're going to have him in quite prominent positions. So he's somebody else for your centre-backs to pick up. But it does pose the question of who does pick him up and who marks who tracks who. Because if your centre-backs get sucked into marking or closing down somebody in the middle, space opens up out wide. And with a back three, there's the potential if your wingers aren't particularly diligent. And it has to be said that I've seen games in which James Rodriguez has been a bit guilty of getting stuck upfield when Everton are defending and leaving, in particular, Coleman behind him under a lot of pressure and sometimes two on one. In those circumstances, you potentially leave gaps out wide, and that is where Leeds are good. You know, that's where they do exploit teams. Harrison on one side, I would expect Rafinha to play a game, both with pace, both very direct, and both will look for gaps to attack. It makes me wonder if Ancelotti will go back to the back four because of what he's coming up against. But it did work at Fulham. You know, the changes he made did make a difference. I don't think Everton were brilliant down there. It was a bit tight and nervy in the end. But I think he'll be well aware that the attacking threat of Leeds will be on a different scale.
What sort of form do you think this one's going to take, Michael? Are we going to dominate this game like we tend to dominate games?
I think it'll be interesting. I think what Phil hit upon there with potential counter-attacking opportunities will be a nice change for us, given the way Arsenal set out, and also Leicester and Palace to an extent of more or less sitting back and waiting for us to do the attacking. I think Everton will try and attack in a way that maybe we haven't seen for a few weeks. So I'm kind of hopeful that we can find a bit of space there. And it always kind of comes down to this with Bielsa's teams, but outwork them to an extent as well, where maybe someone like Rodriguez won't track a man, whereas we know that Harrison will.
Is this something Leeds can exploit with just the sheer physical fitness?
It's not only the intensity, it's the length of time that it lasts for. You never get away from it, and it's really rare to see Bielsa's team drop off. And I think if you haven't played them before, or if you haven't dealt with them or seen too much of them, you perhaps underestimate the fact that they can go all night. And there must be the assumption with opposition teams that eventually the energy and the intensity is going to drop. It's inevitable. You know, maybe go for a half or go for an hour or go for 70 minutes, but there's going to come a point at which they sag and the real pressure lapses and you can take advantage. But I always go back to what Klopp said at the start of the season. He said afterwards, you know, that went on for 95 minutes today. He said for 95 minutes they were like that. And, you know, there was no point at which we were able to properly take control and to properly squeeze them, because they just wouldn't let us do it. So, yeah, I think that's right. I think that's where the game could be won for Leeds on Saturday, is if they, in the way that they quite often do, they prove overwhelming in the key areas of the pitch.
Feels like we're all kind of gearing up towards a good performance on Saturday, so let's hope they don't let us down.
Yeah, absolutely. I feel like that. I didn't actually think the performance at Leicester was terrible. I thought defensively there were issues that they exploited. Against Leicester, the combination of a very poor first half and a difficult pitch, I think, made that result a shoo-in for Leicester. But Arsenal felt more like what we've been seeing from Leeds since the start of the season. It felt more in tune with you know, the greater number of the performances. I thought it was impressive. I thought they were unlucky to draw, and I thought Arsenal were very fortunate to get away with a point.
I think we could get at Everton. I fancy us maybe to take something from this point, or hopefully three.
It feels like it could take on the pattern of the Man City and the Liverpool games, in a bit more of a slugfest, where it's a bit more of a game of basketball as opposed to one team camped in their own half.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's much more likely to be that sort of game than another Wolves, another Leicester, particularly because it's at Goodison Park. But nothing I've seen in Everton under Ancelotti so far this season suggests to me that they're a side who are going to sit in behind the ball.
One of the other things that Bielsa is speaking about is the Tier 3 ranking,
yes,
that we have in West Yorkshire for the foreseeable future. And obviously that has an impact on the ability of fans to attend games.
Yeah, just two interesting things, actually, I was going to pick up on in the press conference. The first was Bielsa being asked about Cleek and, you know, what his initial impression was of Cleek, who's obviously been such a big player for him, and saying quite openly that he thinks Cleek could play for the best teams in the world. He thinks genuinely Cleek could play for just about any side. Well, that's what we were trying to tell him.
What's he talking about? He already is.
And he sort of said he's at Leeds by chance, but I think, you know, he knows himself that what happened in Cleek's first summer was all a bit of pieces falling into place because Forsher was injured, Vieira was injured. He was talking about how at first he'd suggested to Cleek that he might play him at centre-back, which you can probably do actually in a Bielsa team because of what the centre-backs do, but obviously has become this absolutely niche and quality number eight. On the tier system, yeah, so Leeds or West Yorkshire is tier three, which means that despite the suggestions, and I think we probably all saw this coming, but despite the suggestions that crowds could be back in the stadiums very shortly, under the government rules, still no fans allowed in Elland Road. And even if you're in tier two, it's, you know, the maximum of 4,000 fans drops to 2,000 fans. And I think at the level Leeds are playing at and the level we're talking about the Premier League, the return of 4,000 or 2,000 fans feels too insignificant for it to be a massive step forward. As it is, there will be nobody at Elland Road for the foreseeable future. And I think Bielsa was making the point that he's happy to play. I don't mean happy that there are no crowds, but if he goes to a ground where there are fans in, that's fine by him. If he goes to a ground where there aren't any fans equally, they'll get on with it. But he was trying to make the point today that it really needs to be fair across the board. And because crowds do make a difference, because they do influence games and results, it's not entirely fair if you have a bundle of stadiums in the south of the country that can have 2,000-4,000 fans in, and you have stadiums in the north of the country that are not allowed anybody at all. So that was his point, really, which I think I'd broadly agree with. It seems weird to me that the kind of overall policy of football is being dictated by what the government are doing regionally.
Yeah, I hadn't really thought about it from that perspective, that it might give somebody an advantage, because the rules are that you're not allowed to sing and shout, though, aren't they? Which won't come as a change to anybody at the Emirates.
Yeah, well, in non-league and, you know, in the lower leagues, 4,000 fans, it's basically, I think, a maximum of 50%, so whichever is smaller. It's quite a significant number and could completely change the atmosphere of the ground. I think, all joking aside about the Emirates, if you put 4,000 people in there, would you even really notice that 4,000 were in? And financially, does it make sense for the club to have to put all the provisions in place for such a small number? I mean, if we go back to the point where Leeds and other clubs were first talking about trying to reintegrate crowds and to bring people back into the stadiums, they were wanting to do a quarter of the stadium, a third of the stadium. I think Leeds were looking at 8,000 to 10,000, which would have been a significant number and would, you know, would have been the equivalent of what you used to get for the early rounds of the League Cup and so on. It's still, you still feel the difference. But even in Tier 2, if you were allowing 2,000 back into Elland Road, it would be more like the equivalent of the reserve games that we used to go to on a Tuesday night. And I'm not saying some people wouldn't be happy with that. So, not happy, but, you know, some people might want that. That might be enough for them just as a start. But it all feels a little bit pointless and a little bit superficial. And I don't think this is going to be properly solved until they take proper steps towards getting meaningful crowds back in.
How much input has there been from football clubs in these numbers that have come out? Because as you described that, it does seem like a nonsense that you're allowed 4,000 people in the ground like Halifax Town and then 4,000 people in something enormous like the Emirates. It doesn't seem to, from a health point of view, it doesn't seem to necessarily make sense that these numbers are the way they are.
No, I agree with that. And I think that generally with the COVID advice, there are a lot of contradictions and a lot of things that don't seem to add up. I mean, there is constant contact between the Premier League and the government. And obviously there are constant Premier League club meetings as well, where it's been made apparent right from the start that they're desperate to get decent attendances back in. They need it financially. I think they realise as well that the sport is diminished by the fact that there aren't crowds there. I mean, I often wonder how engaged the Leeds support feel this season, you know, given that they haven't been able to go to a single game. They haven't been able to go to a single game since Huddersfield at home back in March. And I know you still get the buzz of results and everything that goes on with Bielsa and the way the team are playing and the clips that you see online of, for example, some of the attacks on Sunday, which were terrific and just classic Bielsa, you know, flowing from front to back with quick passing and movement. But it's, to my mind, better in the flesh always than it is on a television screen. And I found that out as well because I haven't been to every game. You know, we don't get tickets for the press box at every match. The games so far, including Palace, where I've watched on pay-per-view or on Sky and BT Sport. And it isn't the same. You do feel detached. You do feel a distance away from it. You don't, you know, for supporters who go regularly, you don't have the trips to the pub before and after. You don't have all the routines that you go through. And I don't think football would want that to persist for a long time, not just financially, but also aesthetically. It's not good. It's not what the game is. But ultimately, they are completely in the hands of the government and scientific advisors. And I felt when that announcement was made about the return of very small crowds that, yes, it felt like a first step. But in the context of the Premier League and for a club like Leeds, it doesn't mean an awful lot.
Well, let's wrap it up then. And before we do, let's return to Goodison and your one to watch for Saturday evening's match. Can you repeat last week's stellar prediction of Pablo Hernandez being the one to watch? Is he going to be the one to watch again this week?
Let me try and get somebody who is on the pitch. Rodrigo's my one to watch, particularly if he starts and if you've got James Rodriguez on the pitch as well, because you're talking there about real elite footballers. And I think even though they won't be head-to-head on the pitch, I think it'll be a fascinating head-to-head to see how they influence the game. And I've been more and more impressed by Rodrigo. And I just thought on Sunday, bringing him off the bench and then seeing him do what he did and the immediate impact against, you know, what is still a very strong Premier League squad at Arsenal said more and more about the value Leeds have got for that signing. So that's quite a matchup at Goodison Park and I'm looking forward to it.
Rodrigo and Rodriguez.
Yes, indeed.
We'll keep our eyes peeled. Thank you, Phil. Thank you, Michael. Still time to get involved in the Black Friday deal that The Athletic are doing at the minute. Best ever price of just £1 a month for 12 months. You can cancel any time, but you get everything on The Athletic by Phil, plus all the podcasts ad-free as well. That one is running until the 4th of December, so don't miss out. And that's at theathletic.com/LeedsPod. theathletic.com/LeedsPod. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you next time.
The Phil Hay Show.